Hello, hello, and thank you for tuning in to this episode of Wild Virginia Virtual Coffee Talk. I am your host, Katie, and today we are going to be discussing queer ecology or ecologies to recognize the many people and cultures involved in this work. And what that does is aim to break binaries and change how humans interact with the outdoors. And so today we have a former intern from the Nature Conservancy to chat about the subject. And I'm really excited. And so, Susan, thanks so much for joining me today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
So nature's ability to kind of ignore barriers is one way that we can connect queer ideology with climate justice initiatives, which a lot of organizations similar to Wild Virginia are looking to fight. And so let's kind of start at the beginning, though. Can you explain what queer ecology is and why it's important?
Yeah, for sure. So in my mind, queer ecology really refers to two different but complementary things. So as a discipline, it can refer to the application of queer theory to the field of ecology, what the kind of dominant lens of queer theory is doing. It's trying to like break down the paradigms present in the natural sciences. Basically, queer theory explores the like dichotomy between like normative and deviant. And it comes out of like lesbian and gay studies. So it takes up sexuality, but also it takes up other like systems and frameworks that interact with sexuality. So like race, nationality, disability, gender. And so when you apply queer theory to ecology, you're essentially trying to break down the dualisms that are so present in the natural sciences. So like male versus female, dominant versus submissive, cisgender versus transgender, gay versus straight. And breaking down kind of not only these categories that exist kind of conceptually as opposites, but also like the value judgments that are attached to them. And then I guess like the second way that I think of queer ecology is in reference to the practitioners of science. So like queer and kind of like the methodological approach. And that's mostly the idea that like science really isn't as objective as we like to think it is a lot of the times. And so like taking a queer lens to science where you kind of acknowledge the ways that scientists and methodologies are impacted by specific vantage points, like acknowledging that allows you to like more easily point out potential blind spots.
Definitely. I mean, I was going to say it really is about perception and then sort of interpretation and what we've seen sort of scientists abide by in the past and how, you know, things are kind of changing as, you know, we see new cultural norms. And so you wrote this really great piece that sums all of this up. It's called Accepting a Queer Nature. And so let's chat about that article that was featured by the Nature Conservancy and, you know, why the subject is so important to you.
Yeah, so I was really excited to be able to work for the Nature Conservancy last summer. I think they're doing really great work, and especially working on the side of like science communications and kind of talking about the ways that humans interact with the environment. That's like something that's just super important to me for a whole host of reasons. I mean, I think that it's impossible to ignore the impact that humans have on the environment in this like day and age. And so really talking about the ways in which we can be better stewards and the ways in which our science can make us better or worse stewards for the environment is super important to me. But specifically, like talking about queer ecology, that was a subject that was really close to my heart, especially because I was writing it kind of like on the end of Pride Month. And so just like a lot of queer issues were at the forefront of my mind. Like I identify as queer. I'm raised in like a queer household. I have two moms and like a lot of obviously like my greater community and social circle identifies as some identity on the LGBTQ like spectrum. Yeah, like I feel like I've been able to grow up in this time where I've seen kind of queer identities become mainstream. That's really interesting for a lot of reasons. I think it's obviously it's good that like there's kind of less stigma surrounding queer identities, but it's also interesting the way in which like queer identities have become kind of assimilated. And so I feel like, or assimilated and almost like depoliticized. And so I think that like for me, bringing like queer ecology like to what for me was like the kind of like biggest audience I have ever had access to, because the Nature Conservancy obviously like touches a lot of people, and especially in Virginia, it was really exciting to write for an organization which has like the audience that it does. I was interested in kind of repoliticizing and kind of hammering home for people that, you know, queerness is not something that ends with like the legalization of like gay marriage, right? Like it's something that like the ideas that relate to queerness need to be brought into more aspects of our life. And nature is obviously something which we try to pin down, like the natural world, into kind of digestible ideas and concepts that relate to like our human lives. And we can do that to some extent, but when we really try to put nature into binaries, we miss a lot of stuff. And so queer ecology and queer theory as it relates to conservation and the natural world is really exciting to me, because I think it challenges us to resist categorizing nature in this way.
Well, no, very well put. And, you know, talking about your personal story and how it relates to the subject, and I love, we miss a lot of stuff when you put things into these categories, and it's the people who have, you know, traditionally created the categories that you know, we're kind of hopefully changing with queer ecology. And so another motivation I know that you had to write this piece was Patricia Kashian's The Science Underground. So could you summarize this for our listeners?
Yeah, so I'm lucky enough to, Patricia Kashian came to my school, Swarthmore College, and gave a talk on queer mycology, which is her like subject of interest. And so like the article that she wrote, The Science Underground, I think is a really, really great synopsis of queer ecology, and specifically its applications to mycology. And so it really provides a great history of where queer ecological concepts come from. Specifically, she talks about their emergence out of like deconstructionist philosophy, which is another interest of mine, specifically like Jacques Derrida, who's a French philosopher who had a lot of concepts surrounding, or kind of like his main work was like exploring in what ways power interacts with knowledge and causes us to like privilege certain kind of like tools of knowledge above others. So for example, he like has this whole spiel on how we privilege oral presentations over writing, or how we privilege like sight over touch, and also how we privilege like the masculine over feminine. And so she really like takes basically this like zoomed out view of queer ecology, and walks us through its history, and then ends at the application to mycology, which I think is really, really interesting, because it's like super visible how queer ecology like relates to mycology, right? Because mushrooms are somewhere between plants and animals. They're neither one nor the other. And a lot of our understanding of mushrooms has been impacted or limited by like societal mycophobia, the fear of mushrooms, right? And so recently, this makes me think of, right, like the hit show, or I guess this was a game first, but then it became a show, The Last of Us, right, where cordyceps infects humans and it turns them into zombies. There's basically like a million examples of kind of like mushrooms being associated with like creepiness or evil or villainy in popular culture. But like we should, if we were thinking critically about it, we should love mushrooms, right? Like, first of all, I feel like I eat mushrooms kind of every single day, but like, let's talk about the impact of like penicillin, right? That saves countless lives every single year and has probably been like the single most important like medical discovery in the past, what, 150 years. And so, but we like tend to ignore and like look over what fungi and mushrooms have to offer us, because they don't really fall into categories that can be easily studied, right? Like I think there's like they're kind of like sexless creatures, along with them being like between animal and plants, right? There's like certain types of mushrooms that have like over like 20,000 different like sex types that they could fall into, right? So like male, female, and then like 19,000 other sexes that can like determine how they mate. And so, yeah, this is basically just what Patricia Kaishian's article is about, is like flipping the narrative on mushrooms specifically using concepts from queer ecology. And I think one of the most important things that she touches on in this article is the importance of like decentering or kind of like reframing how we look at and use traditional scientific methods, right? So the like Western scientific method is about like replication and standardization, right? Like to get anything published, you have to first you have to like go through the whole like grant process and securing money and like going through university, but then you have to like replicate your study a bunch and make sure it's peer reviewed. We tend to think that like once something has been published in a journal that's like, oh, okay, it's true. Kaishian, I think, does a lot of work on reframing how we should understand like Western science and publications, right? Like they're a means to a truth, but they're not like the capital T truth, right? We should understand science as just one tool for interpreting the world. Along with this, she like does a lot of work to reaffirm the importance of like indigenous ways of knowing and how kind of scientific methods that are not built so heavily upon replication and standardization also have value and can contribute positively to like what we take as true.
Yeah. And, you know, I think in thinking about any part of my own life, I like to use the Swiss cheese model as much as I can. And so using, you know, one tool as the end all be all, or, you know, one truth, as you say. And so, you know, a queer ecological perspective really challenges those notions of nature and the environment by confronting these categories that we've been talking about. And so, you know, you mentioned mushrooms not being easily forced into any type of binary. And so could you speak to any other examples of queer ecological practices or applications or maybe ways that it's been lagging in science in the past?
Yeah, so I think like the main place where queer ecology has a lot of application, or I guess the way I've seen it being applied recently is in kind of like urban concerts of like urban nature, because this obviously is a domain where, and I guess I'm like talking about like parks and gardens and maybe even like zoos or places that are managed by municipalities and are made to engage. So I was reading this paper, which like talked about this one specific park in London called Abney Park. It's like a cemetery. And if you look at it, it's like really, to me, it's super gorgeous, right? It's like the cemetery that basically had been reclaimed by nature, right? So like it became really overgrown and a lot of like the native species came back after like the city of London had kind of like carved out this area and made it like a clean and neat cemetery. They like let it sit for a while. And I thought this article was really interesting because it was looking at how queer theory can be employed to resist kind of manicured urban spaces, which I thought was really awesome, right? Because a lot of what we think like looks good is actually like really bad for like natural ecosystems and for like sustainability writ large. Like, I mean, like think about like, I think like lawns is also a really good example, and like homeowners associations and how they kind of force people to manicure their lawns in a certain way. Like people are only able to plant like one type of grass, and that ultimately like can lead to the crowding out of a lot of like native species and completely like lead to the restructuring of ecosystems. And queer theory kind of can put a wedge in that, right? In the sense that it reconceptualizes design and like manicured spaces versus undesigned and wild spaces. And it can attempt to like reascribe positivity and negativity to both of those like ends on the spectrum, right? And so the idea in like the Abney Park example, they also talked about how the park was ultimately used as like a space for queer gathering and for queer people to meet each other. The wildness of the space interacted with the need for queer people to have like a place where they could covertly meet other queer people. And that was pretty awesome because it really brought out the idea that kind of in like a wild natural space, that's actually good for the like socialization of certain groups. And people can like derive a lot of like pleasure and joy from truly like unmanicured spaces, which is kind of not what the city wanted to happen, right? They wanted to keep this space clean and prim so that it could be used in certain ways. And then once it became overgrown, queer people started using the space in different ways. And so that's like, that's kind of really exciting to me as someone who is also interested in urban planning and thinks that there's a lot of ways in which urban planning really misses how people actually want to use spaces, right? I mean, I think of like how like there's kind of been a mass move in most parks to like replace fun slides with like safe slides and kind of like take away play and like community engagement almost. And so I think like queer theory is really good for changing our views on that.
I love that. And that's really beautiful. I'm going to look up that example on Abney Park, and it just, you know, lawns that were kind of, I think it was born out of, you know, the World War II timeframe and, you know, really, really bad for the environment, really bad for the little critters and buggies that like leaves, and incredibly terrible for our warming planet when you put down a bunch of asphalt and, you know, green lawns without any native plants. It's just, it's too much. And so let's talk about something else that's a little too much. The social justice and environmental racism issue that we've seen, you know, from Wild Virginia's perspective on a number of projects, and whether that's where you're where folks are deciding to put a compressor station for a pipeline, tends to be in Black and Brown communities. That we can come up with a million examples, but let's talk about in what ways queer ecology intersects with the issues of social justice and environmental racism.
Yeah, so I mean, I think queer theory is like impossible to separate from race and racism, especially because like, especially when you like are looking at this under class analysis too, like kind of any marginalized person is likely to be in like affected by environmental injustice in similar ways, right? Yeah, if I can like talk a little bit more about like the Abney Park example. Yeah, like I think that queer ecological concepts really reframed the like urban wild and transformed it from something negative to something positive and valuable. And unfortunately, like if you look at the dominant perspective, which is that the urban wild is like something that we should eradicate, and if there is nature in urban spaces, it needs to be manicured. That led to like the gentrification of like the larger area surrounding the park, and like the City of London did try to like clean it up in I think the 1990s. And obviously, like I think there's like no way to talk about our tendencies to want to hide queerness without talking about our want, our like similar want, and I say we in like the societal sense, like the general sense, our want to like turn away from Brown and Black communities as well. Yeah, I think queer ecology has like a really practical role also in social justice movements, right? Because queer populations are really like at risk, and they face like both social and environmental violence. If we're trying to like solve kind of like the social ills present in our world, right? So like health and economic disparities and the perpetuation of violence and displacement and exploitation and all of these social ills that are really concentrated within marginalized communities. If we're trying to face that, then I think that like kind of where we found strength is through novel perspectives, right? Like I kind of feel like there's no story of like overcoming a problem that starts with, okay, we tried this thing and it didn't work, and we kept trying this thing and it didn't work, but then one day it did, right? Like to kind of overcome anything, if you're trying something and it doesn't work, you need to try something new. I think in terms of like environmental justice, and like social justice, queer ecology is like a novel perspective that we should be trying to like tap into so that we can really use its understanding and its like framework of like kinship and connection and like the bridging together between boundaries. Yeah, to like really just like think of issues more holistically and try to solve them in novel ways.
Well, and I think that's what it takes, kind of generally speaking, when it comes to some of these environmental issues, which, you know, are social justice issues, is, you know, making more meaningful connections, finding those connections in yourself and another group of people. Mm-hmm. Politically, good luck. But I mean, this is something that can offer perspective. And so in our daily lives and environmental practices, queer ecology encourages us really to question our assumptions and embrace that diversity. And so are there other ways that individuals and communities can kind of incorporate queer ecological principles into their own daily lives?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think the first thing I want to say is like kind of this is really hard, right? Because we're humans use classification as like a survival mechanism, right? Like that's the reason that our societies kind of like look the way they do and our interactions look the way they do. And it helps us. But a lot of times we need to like be even more reflective on like the categories that we tend to put things into. And so the first thing I want to say is just like, I think queer ecology does a really good job of teaching us and telling us to resist dualism in our daily life and resist unnecessary categorization, because there is a level to which categorizing is unavoidable and it's helpful, but we're really like we don't usually like we're usually like way past that limit, right? Like I don't know, there's completely unnecessary things that we love to separate into binaries of like male and female or gay and straight. I mean, imagine how happy it would be if like a little boy making like a flower crown wouldn't be called like gay or girly. Like imagine how happier everybody would be if we could just like enjoy things without kind of the threat of social negatives being attached to the way we are and the way nature is. And so I think the first thing is just like it tells us to resist dualism in a really radical way and rethink a lot of the ways that we make kind of implicit categorizations. And I think on like a more practical level, like we talked about earlier, like honestly, like lawn tending and gardening and like pest removal, we could look at through a completely new light with queer ecology. Again, like Patricia Kaishian talks about how we see like any mushroom in our yard as like deadly and like a potential poisoning factor. And so we'll dump like fungicide all over our gardens so that mushrooms don't grow. But like we don't, most of the time, even if a mushroom is like poisonous to a human, right? Like its ecological function is to recycle and remove toxins from the ground and recycle them through like the fruiting body, right? And so they're really productive. And so kind of just like reinterpreting our gut instincts. And so like, yeah, I think like looking critically at like what we consider pests, what we consider weeds, what we think like a good garden or lawn looks like. And also I think just like, I think there's a lot of overlap between queer ecological principles and like indigenous sciences, right? Which are also highly resistive of dualisms. And so I think like really just like tapping into kind of like what indigenous practitioners and stewards of the natural world are like telling us, kind of striving to recompile where we are getting our knowledge from. So yeah, like trying to read from a diversity of perspectives and a diversity of sources, and not just like what scientific, like Western scientific publications are telling us.
To a degree, it's also information passed down and, you know, sort of breaking cycles and what was okay before or what was not okay. And with the whole weeds thing, I mean, it gets me every single year. These beautiful, quote unquote, weeds. People are ripping them out of the ground. And I'm like, what on earth? That is a pretty yellow flower. What is happening here? And so, you know, Susan, I really have appreciated this conversation. And I appreciate you so much for joining Wild Virginia's podcast. And so thank you again. And I just wanted to close out with, what role do you see being accepting of a queer nature really playing in the larger environmental movement? And what do you hope to see in the future of queer ecology for research, activism, climate change, and sustainability?
I think accepting queer nature is important, not only for like the environmental movement, but it's important for like social justice and honestly, like just like accepting ourselves, right? I think a lot of people hold biases that they're not even willing to confront, which impact how they treat themselves, which to me is, I mean, surely I'm also like working through a lot of these, the ways in which that I've been conditioned, but a lot of it is really sad to me. I guess I want to like close out with the idea that like the world we live in is queer, and that's not just like something I believe, that's like a literal scientific fact, right? Like gender identity, maybe like a human phenomenon, but like various animal species exhibit forms of non-binary sex, like various plants and animals are engaged in like homosexual or like bisexual relationships. And so like the identities, like queer identities that exist in the human world, like also have like natural and counterparts, or natural counterparts and counterparts in various ecosystems. And so like understanding that ecological relationships don't exist within binaries, but instead occupy a full spectrum of existence is really important. And I think it's something that the environmental movement, like, I think we're getting there, right? Like, I think people are kind of warming up to this idea, but the sooner that we can kind of get past some of the intellectual tools that have been really like handed down to us in the West, the sooner we can get past those and kind of reframe how we understand and interpret the world and how we do science, like the faster we can really like become, I think, truly like good stewards and like understand what the purpose is. Like, I think a lot of like scientific work kind of misses the point sometimes, which is disappointing. But yeah, I think queering our understanding of nature is really to remove the limits on how we think. It's like essentially, it's just like another way to kind of be open-minded and be willing to accept diversity in unexpected forms, right?